Good morning. We're back for another episode of the Riddles in the Dark podcast. This is a bit of a strange episode. We're recording it in advance because I will be on vacation during the week when we would normally do it live and record it. So this one's been in advance. This week's episode will be focused on Thorin Oakenshield, finally. Probably should have started with him since he's at the center of The Hobbit, but there's just so many, fascinating things to discuss. Anyway, let's get right to it. I'm your co-host, Dave Kale, and let me introduce the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson.
Good morning. Okay, so one of the things that I wanted to address first here today is actually a comment that a listener made on my Facebook page just this morning, which I think brings up a perfectly appropriate comment on my gloom about the Battle of Azanul Bazar in the last episode. Gloria Cole says, "Professor, it sounds like you're preparing yourself for Peter Jackson to kick you in the teeth with this movie." And I realize that when I'm talking about scenes like the Battle of Azanul Bazar, for which I have so much affection, and thinking about them not being included in the film, I can certainly sound like a puppy who's just been kicked. But I guess the main thing I would want to say about this is my own feelings about this. It's not that I am pessimistic about the films. The trailer, I thought, was in general, my general response to the trailer is that I thought it was very encouraging. And I have actually pretty high expectations for the films. But the thing that I always have to keep, to keep in mind for myself is to try to prevent myself from simply fantasizing that the film is going to be all of my favorite parts of the book put on the screen exactly as I've always imagined them, which is of course the temptation. As of course, Dave, you're rightly accusing me of walking a little too close to that line in our first two predictions, or rather at least being quite optimistic that what I want to see will appear in the films. So, I am trying to temper my own expression of what I would really like to see. Not even necessarily what I think would make a great movie, but what I would really like to see on screen, and with what I actually think will probably happen. So, the Battle of Azanul Bazar is a great instance of something which I think would be cool, and I think it would be awesome, but I am not at all confident that they're going to do it. So my actual prediction certainly differs from my kind of private desire, but again, this is just in the spirit of tempering my expectations and not setting myself up for disappointment.
I don't recall that episode being particularly negative or anything like that. Maybe I don't know if that person listened to it, or maybe they just saw the description where we described our the shadow and the threat growing in our sleep.
Yeah. Yes,
that was okay. That sounds a little negative, I guess. But
well, we were kind of implicitly paralleling the prospect of the conflation of the Battle of Azanul Bazar with the Battle of Five Armies with the regrowth of the shadow of Sauron. So
correct.
True. Okay. Maybe that's a little alarmist, but no. I mean, like I said, it was, the prospect is a sober one of that kind of conflation. I think there are good things that could be done with it in some ways, but
I think the point of our conversation last time was not we think Peter Jackson's going to screw this thing up by conflating these two battles. It was rather, we can't imagine a reasonable way to add this into the film. We think that probably it has to be conflated. So we weren't, to the extent that we were speculating that the battles would be conflated and that we would be disappointed, we weren't blaming Peter Jackson or the New Zealand filmmakers. We were saying, this just seems like this is a hard thing to do. We were making the comment that there was simply too much epic stuff to be
too much epic
into,
stuff.
Yes.
The Hobbit, chock full. Can't squeeze all the epicness of The Hobbit into two films.
That's right.
That's the problem.
hey,
yeah.
There was one comment. I can't remember if this was on your Facebook page or maybe on the Mythgard page. There's too many places for people to comment. How do we keep it all straight? Okay, I can't find it. But somebody somewhere, I don't remember who it was, mentioned the possibility that, oh, it's Trish Lambert on your Facebook page. Yeah, there it is.
Yes.
Because if you recall, one of the reasons that we speculated that they would be conflated was that we thought there was room only for one sort of epic flashback thingy at the beginning of the film. You know, that either we would get the Battle of Azanulbazar, laying the groundwork for the dwarves and the goblins hating each other, along with maybe Thror's death, things like that. Or we would get Smaug running them out of the Lonely Mountain. Trish Lambert pointed out that you could get both if you did one for each film, sort of similar to how the Fellowship of the Ring began with the War of the Last Alliance. And then I think it's Return of the King begins with the sort of the tale of Smeagol.
Yes.
So that's a possibility. I'm still not sure, but that's a possibility.
Yeah. Cause I mean, trying to think of how that would actually work. I mean, there's awkwardness to overcome with either option. That is, say you do put the Smaug sequence at the beginning of the first film and Azanulbazar at the beginning of the second film. Well, then you're interrupting, in a sense, like, okay, the story is halfway over. Now, by the way, let's jump back several hundred years for an ancient historical battle, which is – it's not impossible to do, but there's a challenge there, certainly. To sort of make that fit. The Smeagol flashback at the beginning of the Return of the King is different because it is more obviously relevant to, you know, the character right there. I mean, you've got Gollum and that's kind of much clearer, the relevance of it. You know, Azanulbazar would be challenging. You could even theoretically do it the other way and have the flashback to Smaug be at the beginning of the second film so as to set up all of the Smaug business that's going to be in film number two. But it's hard to see not getting that at the beginning of the first film so as to frame the whole, you know, purpose of the quest. But so, I mean, I do think that that's a possibility. You know, let me put it this way. That is the most rational grounds for optimism that I've heard.
Yes.
that the Battle of Azanulbazar will happen.
I
will give it that much.
To add to that, Uncommon Fan on Twitter pointed out that maybe even if they show any of the Smaug attack, they probably won't show Smaug on screen. And maybe that's a reason to believe that they won't show the Smaug attack on screen. That's an interesting point that they basically don't, they won't want to tip their hand in terms of how Smaug's being done on screen. And maybe they won't even have finished the Smaug sequences by the time the first movie's released. So that's an interesting notion too. Now, he points out you could still do the Smaug attack. You just wouldn't show the dragon. You would just show dwarves fleeing fire and glowing halls and whatnot. That's another interesting idea.
Yeah, and I have to say, I love that idea. Love it. I would seriously hope that they would do it that way. I mean, we talked before when we were discussing Thror, I think that there are some serious challenges to doing a full epic attack on Erebor sequence on screen. You know, how you depict that. I mean, not that I think it's impossible, but I think it would be challenging. But the thing that I really love about the uncommon fan's suggestion is that it picks up, I think, very well on the song that the dwarves sing in Bilbo's Hall, the one that, of course, they're singing in the trailer. One of the things that I particularly notice in the song is when they're singing about Smaug and Smaug's attack, they never name him in the song, and they don't even really talk about him. That is, they never actually talk about the dragon. They talk about the effect that he has on the mountain. The pines were roaring on the height. The winds were moaning in the night. The fire was red. It flaming spread. The trees like torches blazed with light. Of course, that's about the attack of the dragon, but it doesn't describe the attack of the dragon. It just describes what happens. And then, in the next stanza, the bells were ringing in the dale, and men looked up with faces pale. And what do they see? We're never told. The dragon's ire, more fierce than fire, laid low their towers and houses frail. That refers to what happens, but note it's not a description. The dragon's ire. That is, we're talking about the rage of the dragon, but still not describing the dragon or naming him or talking about what he's doing. And then again, in the next stanza, the mountains smoked beneath the moon. The dwarves, they heard the tramp of doom. They fled their hall to dying fall beneath his feet, beneath the moon. And again, we have like the disembodied feet of Smaug and the tramp of doom. But, you know, it's like they're kind of going around the edges of Smaug and never really showing him and never really describing him. My own reading of that, by the way, is that, you know, this is like the dwarves not even wanting to kind of give him the honor of being the hero of the attack on the Lonely Mountain story. They want to tell the story of the kind of the consequences, you know, the people who suffered from him and what he did. And they do want to remember what he did, but they don't want to, tell they don't want to make Smaug himself the central figure of that story. So
similar to like Gondor really cool. And Sauron, the kind of the same orientation there.
Right, exactly. So that could be really cool if they kind of picked up on that same kind of thing and didn't have, not that I think that would necessarily be their motivation, but to have, you know, that same sort of thing, the effects of the dragons coming, the trees on fire and, flames spreading and houses burning and people screaming. But no dragon. That would be, I think, very much, or like dragon body parts, you know, like we see with the feet, in that third stanza that I read. So I think that, that would be very cool, but we'll see if it actually occurs.
Interesting. Yeah, that's, I think I'm not sure. I certainly don't think that the Battle of Azanulbazar flashback, if there is one, will be in the second film. If they do Smaug in the first one, I don't think they'll do the Battle of Azanulbazar in the second one, just because I don't think we'll start with a battle and end with a battle. I mean, they had the same kinds of issues with Harry Potter Deathly Hallows. We were talking about this yesterday in terms of the split of the film, which we will talk about a future episode. But we think that looking at Harry Potter Deathly Hallows is a great model, because you get some of the same kind of pacing issues, and you also have this sort of – you have a lot of skirmishes and battles throughout the Harry Potter series. In particular, you have the Death Eaters attacking Hogwarts at the end of the sixth book, and then you have the battle at Hogwarts at the end of the seventh. And they specifically left that battle out of Half-Blood Prince, the film version, because they were worried that it would that it would make the battle at the end of Deathly Hallows even more anticlimactic. They didn't want to sort of spoil the whole notion of a
even more anticlimactic.
Yeah.
little commentary slid in there.
Yeah. Actually, I didn't mean that, because the battle was actually one of the better parts of that film. One of the parts of the film I actually enjoyed.
And now we're moving on to further commentary. All right.
But I don't think we'll. I think if we're going to see the Battle of Azanulbazar, we're going to see it in the first film. And but I don't think they'll move Smaug to the second film either, because the film really is, at least early on, about going and getting him. The Battle of Five Armies is kind of – it's supposed to be kind of a surprise. We're not supposed to anticipate that there's going to be it'll be weird watching the movie anticipating that, but we're not supposed to anticipate it. That's supposed to be – we're supposed to be worried that they're going to come to blows, and then the goblins come out, you catastrophe, right? So
– Right, exactly.
I don't know. I agree that Trisha's comment – and is the most rational grounds for optimism, but I'm I don't know.
Buying it.
Nah, well, I don't know. I just don't know how it's going to work. It'll be interesting to see. What I'm holding out for is that they'll film Battle of Azanulbazar sequences, and even if they can't fit them in, they'll just glom them on in the special features.
Yeah, yeah. There's always that, of course, is the most irrational grounds for optimism. You know, the like, but maybe it'll be in the extended edition.
Yes.
You know, that maybe we'll just be do able to tell ourselves about for anything. Really.
Maybe they'll just do a 1 hour special.
Right, called The Battle of Azanulbazar. Maybe. Maybe. But, yeah. Well, we should probably get to our main topic of the day.
Yes.
And today we are moving on to Thorin himself, as Dave said before. And, you know, the two primary things that I'm really interested to think about Thorin, are actually kind of, well, more intangible things. That is not exactly specific moments. You know, I mean, I have a couple of those that I'm interested in, but kind of more general characterization issues about Thorin, how they're going to handle him in a sense. And the two things that I think are of particular interest are Thorin at the beginning, how Thorin handles, you know, how Thorin handles himself in the Unexpected Party and his relationship with Bilbo and with Gandalf. And then the end, how the film is going to handle the whole dragon sickness, Thorin becoming obsessed with the gold issue. And so those things are, I think, to me, the most interesting questions to think about Thorin and what they're going to be doing with him. But for the first one, of course, this is another place that is for the issue of Thorin at the beginning of the story. This is another place where, once again, we go to the quest of Erebor, because that's obviously – this is one thing which I think has been made most clear by the trailer, is that, you know, that exchange between Gandalf and Thorin, which clearly – I think indicates that they are going in the quest of Erebor direction there with Gandalf and Thorin. So we wanted to start off by kind of reviewing some of that quest of Erebor stuff and the situation that Tolkien was in when he was going back and looking at this stuff after the fact. You know, we've talked before about Appendix A and the quest of Erebor and how this is all basically sort of, you know, retconning the Hobbit that Tolkien was doing after the Lord of the Rings. So David, you had just mentioned that you had been rereading the quest of Erebor and had been really struck by some things there. What were the stuff that you were really noticing this last time you were reading it?
Well, the most interesting thing to me that I don't think I'd even noticed, last time I read it, like the last few times I've read Quest of Erebor, reading through Unfinished Tales, I certainly noticed that a lot of things are presented differently or set up differently. In particular, that Thorin's reaction to Bilbo is so different, as you were mentioning, that he's quite skeptical. Gandalf describes him as Thorin was contemptuous and suspicious. "He is soft," he snorted. "Soft as the mud of his shire and silly. His mother died too soon. You are playing some crooked game of your own, Master Gandalf. I am sure that you have other purposes than helping me." And he's just... You don't see much, if any of that, in the actual... In the Hobbit text proper of Thorin being contemptuous, of Thorin being reluctant to take Bilbo along. He maybe doesn't seem overly enthusiastic in The Hobbit, but he certainly doesn't put up any kind of resistance. He seems to have accepted it at the time of the, you know, when we're in the text that we read in The Hobbit. And the interesting thing to me is the first few times I'd read this, I was sort of imagining it as Tolkien kind of just adding some extra context or maybe trying to change The Hobbit. But this time around, I noticed some commentary from Gandalf at the beginning when he's talking to Frodo and Gimli and whoever else is listening, that Tolkien's sort of using this whole frame thing, the fact that Bilbo is telling the story, to retcon a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, that he's taking advantage of that by pointing out that, you know, that he isn't actually changing the story, that he's going back to, well, that's Bilbo telling the story again. Of course, Bilbo didn't realize, or maybe didn't notice, that Thorin was so upset and was totally mad at Gandalf for pulling this prank on him and bringing him to this fat hobbit's hole. You know, like,
right.
we don't see much of that in The Hobbit, but in this, it's totally presenting it as Thorin's like, what the heck? Is this a joke? There's no way this guy's a burglar. He's going to do any of the things that you said. And that he eventually right. goes along with it, not because he believes that Bilbo really is going to be useful, but just kind of almost, you know, because Gandalf basically threatens him. He
right.
tells him two things. One, he says, I have foresight on me, and I'm telling you right now, if you don't take him, you're not going to succeed. And two, he says, furthermore, if you want anything from me ever again down the road, you'd better do this.
Yeah. 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 I mean, you know, Gandalf, it's true. In the Quest of Erebor, Gandalf goes all in, you know, for in his support of Bilbo. Now, of course, we can see that dynamic in the book as well. He's the one who is Bilbo's champion and mm-hmm. who has kind of most at stake and who has, you know, even in chapter one of The Hobbit, clearly kind of staked his own reputation on Bilbo, and does threaten Thorin. I mean, this is the beautiful thing about so much of Tolkien's retroactive stuff. You know, when he's assimilating the Hobbit story into the Lord of the Rings world, when he's putting things in frames the way that he does. He does a fantastic job of taking the seeds that were already there. You know, so like you compare, for instance, the scene that you were just describing from the Quest of Erebor, and you compare it with a comment that Gandalf does make in the first chapter of The Hobbit, where he says, you know, if I say he's a burglar, and if I say he's a burglar, then a burglar he is or will be when the time comes. And if you don't think so, then you can go back to digging coal. You know, so like he gets, you know, pretty stern with the dwarves. He stakes his own reputation on it, mm-hmm. but it's nothing near to the extent that we get there. Same thing with Thorin. Thorin in chapter one of The Hobbit is indeed, you know, he's described as very haughty. And we can't really tell, of course, because we've just met Thorin. Is this just how he normally is? You know, like, is he just like an arrogant, stuck-up jerk in general, which is always possible, or is he, or is this a reaction to Bilbo? We do get, of course, the famous overheard conversation that is the conversation that Bilbo overhears about is he any good. Now it's Glowin, not Thorin, saying that, you know, will he do? So we know that the dwarves are thinking this. And we know that Thorin does look down on Bilbo. Thorin, there's, you know, the one moment where Thorin shows this most clearly, and I take this as a real smack at Gandalf, actually, is right near the end of the Unexpected Party, when he turns, let's see, where he turns to Bilbo. This is right before he gives his – let's see. Okay, yes. Sorry, I'm looking at a different edition of The Hobbit than the one I used for my book, so I don't know the pages by heart. Gandalf has just finished his explanation. That is why I settled on burglary, especially when I remembered the existence of a side door. And here is our little Bilbo Baggins, the burglar, the chosen and selected burglar. So now let's get on and make some plans. And then Thorin says, very well then, supposing the burglar expert gives us some ideas or suggestions. He turned with mock politeness to Bilbo. And that, I think, he's not just mocking Bilbo, he's mocking Gandalf, right? Gandalf has just finished saying, he is the chosen and selected burglar, and Thorin's like, well, then let's hear some suggestions from the burglar expert. So I think that we can see the tension between Thorin and Gandalf there. We can see his mocking of Bilbo, his low opinion of Bilbo. But to me, the biggest question that's unanswered, the biggest thing which we see in The Quest of Erebor that we don't get at all in Chapter 1 of The Hobbit, is the fact that Gandalf really has to persuade Thorin. That is, the answer to the question, if Thorin thinks so little of Bilbo as he seems to do, and frankly, obviously has reason to do, why does he agree to go at all? you know, what we don't get is from the Quest of Erebor, the late night conversation between Gandalf and Thorin after Bilbo is asleep, when Gandalf is saying the things that you were quoting from before about the foresight being on him and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
That conversation was supposed to have happened in one version of the Quest of Erebor, after Bilbo was in bed. Now, you know, in chapter one of The Hobbit, remember Bilbo over here at the very end of chapter one of The Hobbit, Bilbo overhears Thorin singing a refrain of the We Must Away Our Break of Day song in the next room. So Thorin is presumably in bed already. Now, I guess, you know, whatever, he could have gotten up and had a conversation with Gandalf, but that certainly doesn't, you know, we have absolutely no indication in The Hobbit that that happened. Of course, that's perfectly comfortable within the frame of the later story, because Gandalf says, well, of course, Bilbo didn't know anything about it. He was asleep, so that's why there's no reference to it in The Hobbit. But again, the point is, in The Hobbit, the question of, if Thorin is so uncomfortable, why does he go along anyway? Why does he submit to Gandalf's authority? You know, so Gandalf says, you know, I say he's a burglar, you know, a burglar he is. Well, why doesn't Thorin say, look, you're obviously wrong, forget you? You know, and the Quest of Erebor answers that question, but The Hobbit doesn't answer that question. It never even seems to invite the question. And that seems to me one of the things, if you're thinking about this part of the Quest of Erebor from a sort of retcon perspective, for people not familiar with the term, that means retroactive consistency. You know, when you're going back and fitting something into a story you've already written, Tolkien did this constantly. With all of his different stories, and was fantastic at it. Tolkien is like the best retconner I know. And anyway, so his primary act of retcon there was to explain, to give a kind of external consistency to why this story happens in the first place. You know, you have all of these sort of strange and discordant elements. There doesn't seem to be, based on Bilbo's performance in chapter one of The Hobbit, there seems, we are given reasons the story holds together sort of internally for Bilbo. That's the primary emphasis of chapter one. We're seeing what's going on in Bilbo's mind. These dwarves come into his home, and he's all bewildered and bewothered, and what's going to happen in his Tookish side and his Baggins side, kind of struggling against each other, and then the Took side wins. So we can see internally how this all sort of fits for Bilbo, but we can't see how it all fits for Thorin. You know, like why from his perspective is he going through with it? That question doesn't even seem to get implicitly asked, I think, in the actual Hobbit narrative. And that's therefore the question that he comes back to in the Quest of Erebor. And getting back to the films then, it's clear from the preview that Thorin and Gandalf are going to be having that kind of a conversation. Is it going to go quite the same way as in the Quest of Erebor? I'm not sure. But what I would expect to come from that is that I would expect to see, you know, thinking with as character focused as movies tend to be and as movie makers tend to think, I would expect to see a lot of Bilbo Thorin drama. You know, the sort of the evolving relationship between them. It's kind of implicit in The Hobbit itself. We see these moments, like, you know, we've got that moment that I just quoted, the mock politeness thing in chapter one. We get another moment, you know, after far down the road when Bilbo is going to rescue them from the Elven King's prison. And, you know, Bilbo commends him, is like, well, I see you do make a fine burglar, right? And then culminating in the moment when Thorin is going to chuck him off the wall, when Bilbo reveals that he gave the Arkenstone to Bard. You know, so we can see, you know, there are these dynamics of them personally. And then, of course, no, that's not the culmination. The real culmination then, of course, is at Thorin's deathbed. So, you know, the kind of protracted drama of the relationship between Bilbo and Thorin is already kind of potentially in place. It's an easy thing for them to do, but they're going to have to do a lot of work, especially in the front half, in really building that relationship. And that's what I would kind of expect to see there. But it's going to be really fascinating to see how they do that.
That's certainly true, and it is. I do want to emphasize the sort of, because I think there might be a lot of Tolkien. So we're in an interesting situation with The Hobbit here, where you know, with Lord of the Rings, a lot of the sort of changes and adjustments and stuff they made to adapt things to screen were just that and weren't necessarily right. drawing on any external materials. I think a lot of the changes, I'm sure they're going to make changes to The Hobbit that are specifically designed just for translating it to film. But also a lot of the changes they're going to make are going to be based on incorporating in all this external material. And I think this is definitely going to be one of the significant ones, this relationship mm-hmm. between Thorin and Bilbo and Thorin and Gandalf and a lot of this early interactions between Thorin and Gandalf. And so for our purist readers out there, who I'm sure most of them will have read this, just want to, you know, before, as you prepare for watching this, go read some of these external materials, read yes. the Unfinished Tales, read Appendix A and all that, before, so that when you go watch the film, you don't start freaking out and saying, oh my God, they changed this, they changed that, they made up all this stuff and added it, and it's actually... Right. You're right. Looking at the trailer, it really looks like they're drawing heavily on some of these external materials.
Yeah, no, I'm quite convinced of that. And the same stuff with the same thing with the whole like White Council business,
mm-hmm.
and Galadriel's obvious role in this mm-hmm. film, which I know is another thing which sort of puzzled a lot of Tolkien fans at first. but I mean, it makes sense. Yep. It does, because that's, you know, you've got a pretty major story going on at the same time as The Hobbit, which is the conflict between the White Council and Sauron. So no, absolutely. I think that is a really important thing to do. Now, of course, this is not to say that they're not going to make all these other changes anyway, or even that they're going to adapt from The Quest of Erebor and Appendix A in, you know, all like very direct and very sort of simple and linear ways. But you know, one thing I would add to one of the biggest difficulties, and this is something that's really easy to take for granted, is the fact that you have to import the Lord of the Rings Gandalf into The Hobbit. That's really more challenging than I think people assume. I mean, when, you know, one reaction, you know, it's like, oh, we're going to do a film version of The Hobbit. Well, we've got Gandalf. Oh, goody. Let's get Ian McKellen back. And we've got, you know, we've got more Gandalf time. That's fantastic. Yes, that's true. But one thing that I think is perfectly clear, if you read The Hobbit carefully, Gandalf in The Hobbit is not the same as Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. I mean, he changes a lot. Like, the concept of the character and the concept of what wizards are and how powerful they are and their role in the world, these things are very different in The Lord of the Rings than they are in The Hobbit. So, you can't just equate the two. Gandalf and the stuff he does and the stuff he says in The Hobbit, it's different. There are many times he does things that he wouldn't do, or sort of says things that he wouldn't say. It's not the same person. So just to say now, but of course, from the film perspective, it has to be. I mean, you're going to have Ian McKellen in his Lord of the Rings costume, you know, at least for the first part,
right.
On screen the whole time. So, you know, you've got the Lord of the Rings Gandalf now, just as Tolkien had. And in a sense, like, if I had to give a like one sentence summary of The Quest of Erebor, it would be the Lord of the Rings Gandalf retells the Hobbit story. That's one of the main things that we can see. The way that Gandalf as narrator in The Quest of Erebor retells the story is actually an excellent illustration of the difference between Lord of the Rings Gandalf and Hobbit Gandalf. Mm-hmm. The Hobbit Gandalf just is not that clued in. He doesn't have a really big picture. He doesn't know what's going on, and he's not that powerful. So even just the fact of, like, we've got to put Ian McKellen in his gray robes, that is, we have to get the Lord of the Rings Gandalf in the Hobbit story, is already a really major adaptation that they're having to make. So again, thinking about the Thorin question and how they do Thorin and Bilbo, how they do Thorin, Bilbo, and Gandalf as a kind of, triangle there is going to be really complicated, and it's going to require a lot of adaptation. They're not going to be able to just do it like
right.
it's done in the book at all.
Sounds like we need to spend a whole episode or two on Gandalf down the
on
road.
On Gandalf, yeah, we certainly
yeah,
do.
There are a lot of things, particularly from Unfinished Tales, that I would like to talk about, because you're right. I hadn't really thought of it in terms of the Lord of the Rings Gandalf versus Hobbit Gandalf, but certainly The Quest of Erebor really recasts this story. It makes it easy, you know what I mean? Like, the whole thing, as he recounts it, all boils down to what to do about, you know, Sauron, obviously the necromancer Sauron, and what do we do about him? And, and there's just none of that in The Hobbit that you really see. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I just thought you'd like to go on this fun adventure. And there's all these interactions with Bilbo from earlier where it actually seemed like he would be the right person to send on this. So I think that's something we'll have to address later, but let's not spoil it too much.
Yep. I agree.
What else do we want to talk about, Thorin?
Well, I was thinking towards the end with Thorin. One other sort of short thing along the way, though, again, this is another thing we're going to talk about at another time, is sort of the general issue of Thorin's incompetence. he has some pretty good moments. He comes off reasonably well in the troll encounter, for instance. you know, like, he manages to actually fight off the trolls successfully for a little while. And even the speech he makes, you know, before he comes into the clearing, you know, who's been knocking my people about, is still like, you know, he's got some stature there in making that speech. Doesn't have any weapons, apparently, but he, you know, has some stature. This is why he has to pick up a stick from the fire to fight the trolls with. But anyway, so, you know, he has kind of a moment, and he has my favorite Thorin leadership moment of the whole book. Okay, no, second favorite. Battle of Five Armies, of course, has to be number one, but my favorite, other than the Battle of Five Armies, is when the dragon is coming to attack their camp, and everyone's like, you know, Bomber is, you know, Bifur and Bomber are down in the valley. They will be killed. And all the other dwarves are just in despair. We can do nothing, they say. And Thorin says, nonsense. And he starts giving orders. And my favorite moment is he says, you know, Fili and Kili and Balin and Bilbo, get into the tunnel. The dragon shan't have all of us, he says. And that's just like, that's, you know, there we go. Now we see Thorin actually as a leader, making decisions and being self-sacrificial, and it's, you know, it's good stuff right there. But also, a whole bunch of the time, he looks like a git, as do all of the dwarves. So, you know, again, that will be another thing that will be interesting, kind of the general question of exactly how competent will Thorin be? How much growth will he have? Obviously, they're going to give his character some kind of trajectory. I say obviously because they went out of their way, way out of their way, to do that in the Lord of the Rings films, like with Aragorn, for instance. So if Thorin is kind of in the Aragorn place in this film, which in some ways he seems to be, I am quite sure they're going to give his character, you know, some kind of a coherent character arc. Even in the book, he's got one, so they're clearly going to develop that. And I'm kind of wondering how much growth is going to be incorporated into that. Is he going to be sort of lesser and you know, lesser in stature and lesser in competence at the beginning and improving as he goes on, or is his trajectory going to be completely different from that?
That's true. That's a good question. With Aragorn, what they had to do with him was sort of to kind of shrink him almost, like, mm-hmm. like I would, in general, character stuff is one of my bigger complaints. Anyone that knows me, and probably even some of your listeners, would know that there's some characters that when I read through the books again and I think about what they did in the films, I'm just not very happy. And Aragorn's one of those. Because they, in order to have sort of a, you know, a human kind of arc, they had to sort of make him more reluctant, more conflicted, not as epic, not as put together. With Thorin, I don't know if they necessarily, because I mean, that's sort of already there in the text, because he certainly doesn't strike you as a really great leader early in the book. Like, Gandalf is leading their expedition right up until the edge of Mirkwood when he leaves them, and then Bilbo takes over pretty quickly, and Thorin doesn't really, like, he makes some decisions here and there, he doesn't demonstrate great leadership, I don't think. And so I think that's he kind of, even toward the end of the book, he doesn't seem like a great leader until the actual battle with the goblins, mm-hmm. when he comes out and he's you know, shouting to me and stuff. And then he doesn't really, you know, his dignity, unfortunately, is really confirmed in his death. The fact that he dies well and has all these realizations is what really, like, nails down his character. So I think a lot of that's already there. What I wonder is if maybe they'll do something, they'll make his arc different instead of it going from being sort of this guy that's kind of being swept along in the current of Gandalf's scheming, to maybe making him more of a leader early on, and make his arc more about less about going from being sort of a guy being tossed about on the oceans of the tides of fate or whatever. Make it more about him being a leader but going in the wrong direction, you know, that he's greedy and that he's going to be a bad king, and then he's redeemed at the end.
And the and you know and it will be interesting to see how they join those two together. And then that sort of leads me to my last kind of general pondering about Thorin is the greedy business. How prominent is the greed going to be played up in the film version? I mean, clearly there's going to be conflict. I mean, you have this perfect, you know, built in inter-character tension between the two leaders of their company, Thorin, the technical leader, and Bilbo, the de facto leader, you know, culminating on Thorin threatening to throw Bilbo down onto the rocks from the wall, at the end, you know, so I can't imagine them not taking advantage of that in the films. But what role is the greed, the obsession with the dragon treasure, going to be? Because it plays a huge role in the book. In fact, it's one of the dominant themes of the second half of the book. It turns out that the defeat of the dragon, it's not like the defeat of the dragon is a small deal, but the defeat of the dragon is not the focus of the end of the story, of course, you know, as is emphasized at the beginning of chapter 15, when the dwarves and Bilbo first hear about the death of the dragon, and Bilbo thinks that the adventure is properly speaking over, but he's quite mistaken, as we're told. So, no, this is not the end. The end is when we reconcile the whole, Thorin becoming an actually good king and him dealing with the temptation to become dragonish himself. So are they going to do that? Are they going to do the obsession with the treasure? And how big of a role is the obsession with the treasure going to play? It's hard. I'm really not sure. I'm not sure how to guess what they're going to do there. I mean, because it also seems sort of potentially, anyway, if they're going to play up the front half. See, Thorin works interestingly this way in the book because he is kind of a cipher at the beginning. Not a complete cipher, but we don't get that, like, I am a conflicted leader at the beginning. We don't see inside Thorin's head very much. Mm-hmm. The only times we begin to really see Thorin struggling with stuff is at the end when he's struggling with the treasure business. Mm-hmm. So if we've already gotten, you know, Richard Armitage making soulful speeches throughout the first film, you know, and we see him struggling with things and developing, and then to add a new dimension of, oh, by the way, and I'm also really tempted to now become obsessed with the gold and to put, you know, this, to put the treasure before, you know, the welfare of other people, including myself, then that becomes, you know, potentially a kind of a complicating dynamic for the character development.
Yes. Yeah, I wonder. I mean, the one thing they could portray that doesn't, in my opinion, come across as much in the book is portray what happens with him and the treasure and his reaction to the elves and the men and stuff as an actual fall.
Yeah, I mean, this is, like I say, it's clearly one of the things that The Hobbit as a book is really interested in, especially in the second half. And this is a thing which is, you know, here Tolkien is picking up on, you know, major themes that he was really interested in. Beowulf is very interested in this question. I mean, the dragon at the end of Beowulf is, you know, very much involved with this idea of our relationship to treasure and how, you know, what is the proper attitude, you know, the correct attitude to have towards wealth and things like that. I mean, the dragon sequence in Beowulf is clearly very interested in that. You know, and we don't just need Tolkien's own scholarship on Beowulf to show us how interested Tolkien was in this. You know, this of course is, I think, the primary usefulness of noticing the Beowulf reference in The Hobbit. That is when Bilbo sneaks in and steals the golden cup. That's a scene that's taken straight, well, okay, not quite straight, but adapted very closely from Beowulf, where a small thief sneaks into a dragon's lair and steals a golden-handed cup, a two-handed golden cup, and after he does, the dragon wakes up and realizes that it's gone and gets furiously angry and goes out and sets fire to the local village and starts destroying things. So that's you know, that sequence is obviously that is the sequence in The Hobbit obviously has Beowulf in mind, and so thinking about what's going on there in the Beowulf dragon sequence and what's going on in the larger Hobbit dragon sequence. I mean, larger because larger than just Smaug himself. The dragon sequence doesn't really end until the Battle of Five Armies. Thorin is the continuation of the dragon sequence. So like I say, it's a major interest in the book. Are they going to do it? And I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, of course, obviously, that's a second movie question. And it's going to be an issue with the second movie. And I don't think we've gotten, you know, that Peter Jackson has tipped his hand too much about the second film. So maybe we'll see, you know, when we finally get things like trailers for movie two, we will get some indication of what of, you know, some kind of the focus and interests of the second film, and if they are going to expand in that direction. But
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. I'm very curious to see what they do with the characters. This is something we're going to return to in a future episode, sort of the humor of The Hobbit. I think that's been a major question ever since people even started speculating about whether Peter Jackson would do A Hobbit, much less got it confirmed. Mm-hmm. And I think that's tied inextricably to the characterization issues we're talking about here, because they're, some of these characters are kind of buffoons or goofballs, yes, at times. Yes. And it can make it hard to take them seriously as epic characters or heroes or leaders when they behave that way. So I'll be interested to see how they decide to portray that. I mean, I think when you're reading these books, It's and you're familiar with Tolkien, it's easy to remind yourself that this is a story being told by Bilbo, and that Bilbo seemed to have a very sort of an interesting sort of way to go about telling stories and looking on things. He's very much a, especially sort of post-adventure Bilbo. The Bilbo we see at the beginning of The Lord of the Rings is a very jovial kind of humorous guy and remembered these things fondly. And this adventure not darkly at all. And so it's easy to imagine as you read through this and when it conflicts with sort of the experience you have with The Lord of the Rings to think, oh, that's Bilbo telling the story the way he would. I think it'll be harder to keep that in mind when we're watching the film. And so I'm very interested to see how they handle the humor stuff. But we can hit that on a future episode, I guess.
Yep. Yep.
Do you want to are there any other sort of general Thorin things you want to cover? Anything maybe about his backstory or anything? Or do you want to get on to our prediction of the episode?
Well, I mean, the Thorin backstory, as differentiated from the Thrain and Thror backstory that we've already talked about, is actually not all that much other than, you know, the fact that he has some – I mean, the thing that he emphasizes, that Thorin emphasizes in Chapter 1 of The Hobbit, is that, you know – they have a bit laid by and are not too badly off. That is, they have established homes. They're not vagabonds. They're not just, you know, they're not living in destitution somewhere. Mm-hmm. They have established homes over in the Blue Mountains, and they are working, you know, they have been doing blacksmith work, and sometimes, he says, have sunk even to coal mining. But clearly they have kind of worked their way back. It's been a long time. It's been over 50 years since Erebor fell. And over the last couple decades, they have carved out a niche for themselves and have been doing okay, but still are wanting to return to Erebor. Of course – oh, that's another thing. I can't believe we haven't mentioned this yet. The biggest issue – the biggest adaptation, and this is like nothing, this is not a speculation. This is clear. This was clear the moment they cast Thorin. And was one of the most shocking things about it. Thorin is 200 years old, in The Hobbit. That he is an old dwarf. He is the oldest dwarf on the entire, of the entire party. Significantly the oldest dwarf. So he should be a white-bearded old dwarf if you were depicting it as Thorin is described in the book. As soon as they announced that they had cast Richard Armitage as Thorin, and he was one of the only new actors that is obviously not people like Ian McKellen. Of all of the new actors that they cast in the movie, he was one of the only ones whose work I had seen quite a bit of before. I haven't gotten around to watching Sherlock yet, though I'm looking forward to doing so someday. I haven't yet, so I haven't ever actually seen Martin Freeman. But I have seen Richard Armitage, and so I was surprised, very surprised. I was like, why are we getting a young studly Thorin? I mean, I can understand they want him to be attractive. They don't want him to just be an old man on screen. But it's a very interesting choice to depict a young, if he's going to be like a young, embittered Thorin, it radically alters his character and therefore radically informs his character trajectory than to make him, stuck in his ways 200-year-old dwarf.
That's a interesting point. I hadn't even considered that possibility, but he is supposed to be the older one.
Yeah, Balin is the second oldest. They've made Balin old. Yes. Balin is the white-haired one in all the images that they've shown, which is accurate. Balin is old and is called Old Balin at various points, but Thorin's older, significantly older than Balin. It's a huge change. But it's kind of interesting. I wonder if it's going to end up being sort of like Frodo. I mean, it was like in the Fellowship of the Ring, one of the biggest changes that they made was making Frodo so young. He was supposed to be 50 when he went on the quest when he took off with the ring. There was a 17-year gap between the long expected party and his departure from the Shire. So they skipped that. I mean, it's been like they make it look like it's been about a week and a half between when Bilbo leaves and when Frodo leaves. But what was interesting, and I remember Philippa Boyens actually commenting on this in the director's commentary on the Fellowship of the Ring, that it was one of the biggest changes they made in the adaptation. Almost nobody commented on it. It was something that everybody seemed to just kind of take in stride, whereas they were Tolkien fans were really focused on a bunch of the other changes that were made in the Fellowship of the Ring and scarcely even commented on this one. And I'm kind of wondering if the Age of Thorin is going to end up kind of being in that same category for The Hobbit, a radical change which people are just going to kind of swallow and not worry about too much.
Right. Yeah, I guess it's easy to not imagine. I guess the big thing is it's not clear sort of how that will affect his character in the story, to what degree was his age and his position in the world really an impact on the story as you read it through. And it's not clear that it's a huge issue that people have his age, in the foremost of their mind as they're reading it. And so I think the same thing happened with Frodo, because you're right, I didn't notice that until I went back and I'll be honest, the first time I saw these films, I hadn't read the books in a while, and there were a lot of things I didn't catch. And it wasn't until subsequent readings of the book and then subsequent viewings of the book that things started driving me nuts. It was like, oh, wait, they changed. I didn't even notice that the first time.
I'm retroactively offended by that.
That's right, yes.
Right.
And so I wonder if the same thing here, it's that I agree that I think this is going to be one of those things that's going to pass. I think he did look younger than I expected, but it was sort of – you kind of just accept that nobody's going to look quite the way you expect, because casting is casting is difficult, and it's also complicated by a lot of external issues that, you know,
right.
beyond how good a fit for this character is this actor, you know, also how many, you know, how well is this character going to appeal to this demographic of the viewing audience?
Of course. Yeah.
And it yep. seems pretty obvious that they definitely want these dwarf characters, especially the main one, to appear attractive and heroic and sympathetic to the popular, you know, watching audience, I think.
Right. No, exactly. But this is why what I will be interested in seeing is exactly the kind of role that his age plays, if any, in his mm-hmm. in his character development in the film. To go back to the Frodo instance, I think that we can see in the Lord of the Rings films a fairly significant role that Frodo's youth plays in his position and in his character development. I mean, the story is in large part, at least a large dimension of Frodo's own character trajectory in the Lord of the Rings films is a kind of coming of age thing. He's very young and he's, you know, kind of innocent at the beginning, and his loss of his innocence and as well as his own growth and maturity, is a major part, I think, of what they're doing in the film. And that's one of the consequences of their reducing that, which I think was quite deliberate on their part, that they wanted him to be, you know, sort of young and naive at the beginning of the quest, mm-hmm. And not be this, you know, sort of staid old bachelor of 50. In the book, it's important because he is very much in a position, not exactly of authority, but he is certainly more wise and significantly older than the other hobbits. So he is, like, clearly the senior hobbit of the four.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, as is of course exaggerated by his also being in a master servant relationship with Sam, so that really changes the dynamic. And of course, Frodo's youth has a profound effect on the Frodo Sam dynamic in the films.
Mm-hmm.
But I will be interested to see if there is a similar effect. Or that is, if they kind of capitalize on that, on the effect of Thorin's youth, in a similar kind of way. Because it does, having him be younger does open up some things to them that they couldn't do if he looked, I was going to say,
That's
if
true.
He looked 200. I don't know how you look 200. But if he looked really old, there would be some things they just couldn't do with his character. They couldn't do some kinds of development. I mean, there couldn't be any kind of a coming of age thing to it. Because
also, this maybe makes the whole Gandalf thing a little – it reduces some of the tension there if he's significantly less experienced. You know, it maybe makes it –
Yes.
It makes it easier to believe that he would just kind of go along with whatever Gandalf said. You know
– Yes.
Probably, I guess we should, in fairness, point out that we actually have no idea, while he looks young, we really have no idea how old he actually is supposed to be.
Right.
You know, maybe they're doing something funky with sort of the way that dwarves age, and in particular the way that that maybe the heirs of Durin, maybe
right.
because they are supposed to be particularly long lived, maybe they don't look their age, or maybe he's dyeing his hair.
Oh yeah, I'm sure that's it. Now that would be an interesting dynamic to Thorin's character, but yeah, no,
a certain vanity.
Yeah, exactly. No, you make an excellent point. That's where I can, you know, as soon as you mention that, I can see that really clearly. That's an inescapable consequence of making him younger, is to change the dynamics between him and Gandalf, because then there is no question about the fact that Gandalf is the senior statesman of the two. And that even thinking about now, just kind of visually picturing that exchange between Gandalf and Thorin in the trailer, there is almost a kind of a, you know, mentor-student relationship between them that you could see at least potentially being depicted there. Whereas if you depict a white-bearded Thorin talking to Gandalf, the two of them are like colleagues. I mean, they would be more – even visually, they would look like peers.
Yep.
Whereas here, Gandalf – even if Thorin is rebelling against him, even if Thorin, you know, has an attitude and doesn't view him as a mentor or anything, to the audience, it's going to be clear where the wisdom differential is, you know, where the, you know, how that works. So I think that that's going to be, whether they make hay out of it or not, that's going to be an impact of having Thorin look younger, significantly younger than Gandalf. But we'll see. I mean, I kind of expect them to make hay out of it. As I said, I thought that they did some very interesting and sensitive things with Frodo,
yeah,
in that way. So I would kind of expect them to be similarly sensitive to those,
yeah,
dynamics.
The one thing I will say about them is while I often find myself disagreeing with decisions, not even often, but I do find myself disagreeing with decisions they make, very rarely does it seem as though they're making those decisions for no reason.
Right.
They usually have thought things through quite well and usually have particular reasons for doing it. And they're nearly always reasons that you can understand even if you don't accept them. So,
right.
So,
and you know, and I, yeah, yeah, exactly. And I will say those are the only parts of the Lord of the Rings films that annoy me are the places where it seems like, where I feel like that just doesn't seem to me to have been thought through as well as it should have been. Even places, you know, like the famous example that I've often given is Faramir. As mm-hmm. much as I love Faramir and as much as I miss the book Faramir when I'm watching the films, you know, the whole like daddy thing that Peter Jackson does with Faramir is really well done. And I think that, you know, there's lots of good stuff there. It's thoughtful. It's interesting.
Yeah.
So I do agree with you in kind of holding out hope that even if in the end I would have done it differently and I don't like it, I do have that kind of respect for them as well. All right, we should probably get to our actual prediction.
Yep,
because I
got to
go
to
bed here soon. So our prediction this week is about Thorin and sort of a specific scene thing about Thorin. I was thinking about what, you know, sort of some particular Thorin moments in the book, wondering if they're going to make it in. And the one I was primarily thinking about was was the spiders, the whole Elven King thing. So why don't we, let's see. Dave, why don't you read the question and then we can kind of talk about some of the issues involved in the question, and then we'll give our predictions.
Yes. So this is a specific scene question, and just to let our listeners in a little bit on the process of choosing these questions, oftentimes we pick the questions our number one priority with the questions is to pick good questions that make for good sort of objectively measurable predictions where we can actually, where it's easy to lay out some different options and answers that people can pick, and it will be easier to tell whether we were right or wrong.
Right.
I think even the first two or three questions that we did, there's a little ambiguity between some of the answers that make those, problematic. Like some of our people were pointing out that like, oh, this answer is actually not exclusive, mutually exclusive with this answer. And it's like, right. Shoot. So, you know, while it would be fun to make predictions about, you know, various things that we've been talking about with Thorin, like predicting whether Thorin will be portrayed this way or that way, is not a very good question because it will be debatable. So
right.
we're really going to try to emphasize as time goes on and we sort of get better at picking these questions, emphasize questions where we have a specific thing, that we can come up with specific mutually exclusive answers, and then the answers can be easily, we can easily judge whether we were right or wrong. And so
right.
We're trying to experiment this week with a very specific scene. The question is, how is Thorin going to end up in the Elven King's dungeon? And Corey, this was Corey's idea, so he can explain in a second why we're even asking this question. But answer A is just as in the book. If our listeners recall from the readings of The Hobbit, Thorin actually does not get captured by the spiders. He actually is captured by the elves before we even encounter spiders, and that the dwarves get captured by the spiders, I think, when they're kind of looking for their lost companions. So option A is just as in the book, he will be taken by the elves prior to the spider conflict. Option B is that he will actually be present at the spider fight, and that he will be captured with the rest of the dwarves. They won't be separated. And then option C is neither of the above. It will be via some some device that we have not yet imagined. And we expect that maybe our analysts might add a couple of answers to this question as the weeks go on. So we'll see. But we have just the three.
Yeah. And basically, here's my thought, which kind of inspired this question. And that is, it's going to be interesting to leave Thorin out of the spider sequence. I am operating on the following two assumptions about the spider sequence. Assumption number one, the spider sequence will get a good deal of screen time as an epic combat sequence. That's my assumption number one. My assumption number two is that within that epic battle sequence, which will be the conflict with the spiders on film that I'm assuming is going to happen, I'm also assuming that the dwarves are going to receive a lot more positive screen time than they get in the book. In the books, they don't do very much. I mean, the spider incident, this is Bilbo's first big Bilbo as hero moment. He is the hero of that entire sequence. The rest of the dwarves do very little. Balin gets some, like, cool moments. Bomber gets another, like, doofus moment. But actually, that's not quite fair. Actually, I think the thing with Bomber is kind of a turning, not quite a turning point, but sort of pointing to a shift in his character in the book at this point. But that's for another time. However, in general, the dwarves don't do all that much, and what they do is not emphasized very much, whereas Bilbo's actions are all the focus. I guess this isn't an assumption. This is a guess. This is a prediction itself. I would predict that the dwarves are going to get a lot more FaceTime and are going to look a lot more competent during the spider fight sequence. Now, with those two assumptions, with those two premises in place, the question that then comes to my mind is, so is Peter Jackson going to actually leave Thorin out of it? If he's going to raise the profile of it, and if he's going to raise the profile of the dwarves within the spider sequence, having Thorin miss out on that is missing out on a lot of opportunity. I mean, it's since the dwarves were kind of as a group are like, they're the objects. They're the ones being rescued by Bilbo. Whether or not Thorin is included among those people who are rescued by Bilbo is sort of a smaller deal. But in the if he does expand it, Thorin's absence is really kind of a hole. That is, it would leave a hole, I think, in the experience of the audience. And I could imagine the filmmakers being tempted to have Thorin involved in that. In some way, even if just as a moment, in this moment when Bilbo really emerges as a leader among them for the first time, does his first really important and concrete acts of leadership and heroism, what's Thorin thinking and feeling? You know, what's Thorin doing? And to get that kind of, you know, the kind of tension and potential rivalry between Thorin and Bilbo, you know, I'm not sure they're going to be able to pass that up. So. Are they going to handle it the same way? So now I was tempted just to make the prediction question be, is Thorin going to be there with the spiders or not? But I'd rather have a multiple choice than just a yes or no question. And this also then opens up how they're going to handle the Elven King sequence. Because, of course, another thing which leads me to think that they're going to change this is that you have another duplicate. That is, we get two separate captive dwarves standing before the throne of the Elven King and being interrogated by him scenes in The Hobbit. It happens with Thorin at the very end of Chapter 8, and it happens with the rest of the dwarves, with Balin as their spokesman, in Chapter 9. And, you know, they ask them similar questions, and then they throw them all in prison. It's hard for me to imagine them doing – maybe they will, but it's hard for me to imagine them doing both of those sequences, so I can kind of imagine them – you know, maybe they still separate Thorin and single him out and throw him in a separate dungeon or something so that nobody knows where he is. But I would think that I could easily imagine those two – interrogation before the throne of the Elven King scenes being combined into one. Mm-hmm. So as you can probably guess, my prediction is B. I think that that's where they're going to go with this. But I'm not sure. I mean, I could also see, you know, the original way it is in the book would also work, and I don't want to close I don't want to be so silly as to suggest that those are the only two possibilities I can imagine, you know, that they might imagine. So,
right.
You know. Anyway, so I say B.
Interesting. Well, I think I'm going to go with A, believe it or not.
Really?
So we're back off the same, back on different pages again. Well,
and we're differing in the sense of you being more hopeful that they're going to stick to the plot of the book.
Yeah,
that's new.
Well, I'm going to also let the listeners in on a little bit of the way that we approach the show too. That sort of in general, I think this show is going to be more interesting if we have wide disagreement amongst everyone predicting. So
you always like that anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Even that's true. I love Discord. What can I say? I'm Melkor. So when I don't have a compelling reason to pick the same answer as you do, like when I don't like last time with the Battle of Azanulbazar, I just felt like unavoidably compelled to choose that it would be conflated partially. Like I just like it just deep in my core, I'm like, I'm sure that's how they'll do it. Here I'm not really sure, and so my sort of strategy is to pick different when I don't feel compelled to pick the same. And you opened the door when you said you could imagine it sort of going variety of ways. I see your point about why it would make sense to have Thorin be at this fight, but I think maybe I don't see any reason why he has to be. You know, they could play up his role as a hero during the confrontation with the trolls, and it looks like they're changing that scene. They're not just going to have them wander in one at a time and get captured. It looks like they have some sort of
no.
Yes, it looks like they're going to have some kind of dwarven mad rush to attack the trolls or something. It looks like they're going to make that an actual fight scene, which should be
slightly
interesting.
Slightly better strategy, you have
yes,
to admit.
Yeah. I wonder if then the trolls will be, when the trolls are shouting their very, very pedantic names, Bill and Tom and whatever they were.
Yes.
I'm imagining now those trolls shouting that while they're fighting, you know, oh, wait, watch out, Bill!
Right.
I can see Thorin being heroic there. I can see him being heroic in the when they're confronting the goblins and the Misty Mountains, all these things. And so I can imagine them deciding, like, let's kidnap Thorin out of this scene, have the dwarves follow the book sort of roughly. And then maybe by the time that we get to the Elven King's dungeons to the Elven King's halls, maybe they haul Thorin along with the other dwarves in front of him. And they're like, oh, look, there's Thorin. And Thorin's like, yeah, they got me first or something. So I'm not really sure. And so I think I'm going to go with A, that his capture will go along the same way. And then maybe they'll start making changes when we're actually at the Elven King's halls.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think you're wrong, but that's a very interesting perspective. I think it could work. I think that potential for, you know, the moment where like we get the looks of, you know, Thorin looking over, you know, in envy at Bilbo as Bilbo is sort of establishing himself, and everybody looking at Bilbo for leadership, and Thorin kind of trailing along behind. You know, there's a lot of possibilities for building tension there, which
that is an excellent point.
So, you know, but we'll see. I mean, there's also plenty of potential to do that elsewhere, so maybe. But all right. Well, I gotta run, but
yep.
this has been another fun episode, and I'm looking forward to seeing it air, well, in several weeks actually. Anyway, so thank you guys as always for your comments and your questions and suggestions. Keep those coming, and we look forward to continuing to expand the conversation as the weeks go on. Thanks for listening, everybody, and Godspeed.